Welcome everyone to not only another episode of the Damage Report, but a Wednesday episode bringing to you not only news, you know, from across the country, and in fact in our E block from throughout the world when we do our climate change news roundup, but also J.R. Jackson.
Wow.
How's it going?
What's up? What's up?
You're in a very red motif today. Hey, red, you know, hat. What? I was worried for a second.
So what? Because it means danger. We're in the red zone.
Exactly.
There is a red zone alert going on. Am I right? Is that what they're calling it? With the climate situation in our world?
There is, actually. And that's so you're again alluding to that E block. We're gonna give you a couple different stories, all of them scary.
Also the heat way as well. I came prepared for today's topic matter.
Yes, it's camouflage for our ever heating world. But we're gonna be talking about a lot today. We've got a little bit more on Donald Trump's recent political strategy over the past few days. We're gonna evaluate that. We've got a Senate candidate from Texas, Seema Hernandez, is gonna be joining us. Very exciting challenge to Senator Cornyn. We've got updates on R. Kelly, on Jeffrey Epstein, and Joe Biden standing strong against Donald Trump. We're gonna debate that and see what we think about his most recent tactic. So lots to get to. Why don't we jump into it, starting with Donald Trump? So ever since the weekend when Donald Trump went on his racist rant against the squad, there's been this debate. Is this a political strategy? Is this him being racist? What is it? And very quickly, people seem to jump into one area, attempting to describe the president's racist attacks against these women of color in government as like a plan, a strategy, a tactic. And that was actually predicted almost immediately by Dave Weigel on Twitter, who said someone is absolutely working on a Trump is playing 3D chess by forcing Dems to defend Ilhan Omar take. He was joking there, as he often does on Twitter, but he was not wrong. Almost instantly, like across the spectrum, Breitbart had Dems fall for Trump trap, their headline. You've got NBC Politics analysis. President Trump wants the Democratic Party stuck to its progressive fringe so that he can portray his opponents as too extreme to lead the country. As Democrats defended Speaker Pelosi, he moved quickly, sending some tweets to flip the script. All the way to the CBC, who says tweets condemned as racist are part of Trump's plan, and strategists say it may work. So that's a lot of them right there. And the thing is, I think that they're like, we can disagree. Maybe you think that this is a plan, and I'll let you make that case in a second. But there is this attempt to always, like, we have had it drilled into our head over and over and over for years now that Donald Trump is a moron. And yet we still like fear that behind the stupidity is this genius strategist. And that is what he is doing here, is he is deploying his strategy. It's not just knee-jerk racism or anything like that. It's strategy. What do you think?
Have we been told that he's a genius over all these years?
I feel like this is a consistent take that when he goes crazy about the caravans, this is master strategy. Like, he understands his base, he understands American politics.
I thought you meant we considered himself an idiot over the years before his political life, you know? Because that's what we weren't doing. I mean, as a general public, like, he's a billionaire, he's the greatest businessman on earth, the art of the deal. All that was portrayed, that was part of his, what's got him elected, honestly, was this portrayal of him as this guy who can change, run the government like a business. The businesses he always ran so well. And it kept pushing that narrative that was could be factually like disputed, and it was, but nobody cared because they said, hey, we like propaganda instead. So, I mean, even before, during, and will be after this guy's presidency, you're going to see instances of his racial background and the way he does things. So there's really no, I don't think there's much of an argument as to whether or not he's a racist. It is. He wasn't running for president when he talked about the Central Park Five. And by the way, when he was running for president, he still talked about Central Park Five in wrong ways. So I don't know. It's all just, if you continue to push the narrative, enough people will believe it. And then enough people that want to believe it will continue on as well. That's why they had an issue with just the term being used in the first place. Because if we have to talk about this, we have to do it on those terms. And that's one term that they haven't been able to completely, fully say, well, it's okay to be a racist. Just dance around it. And until he actually says the N-word, then he's actually not a racist. He hasn't admitted to it yet. Until he says, yeah, I'm a straight up racist.
I fear that would not be enough. I mean, like, what? Is Tucker Carlson going to go on a show that night and be like, yep, he said the N-word. I guess he is a racist. I have a feeling they'll find a way to defend him.
Definitely fine.
Even in that case.
But also, I'm sorry. So with the approach that he's having, this three-dimensional chess, and he's playing everybody in the media, there's never a plan. It starts with him doing this. We've seen many instances of him blindsiding his staff in the White House with things that he says. And then once he says it, this is the spin that comes. And yeah, the media is assisting in that spin. Yeah.
And look, to that, so I want to give credit to Media Matters, particularly Matthew Gertz, who has a tweet that I think should be case closed on the, this was a plan that they rolled out. Like he was sitting in the shadows and he was watching the squad versus Pelosi and all the fighting and everything. He decided, you know what, I'm gonna wed them together. Because he noticed that about 20 minutes before that morning's Trump rant, Fox and France ran a segment about the squad and aired comments. Representatives Rashida Tlaib and Ayanna Pressley, both born in the US, made a Networks Nation. On the left, Fox and Friends Sunday, 8:06 a.m. On the right, Trump, just 21 minutes later. So it seems like once again, what happened is he was sitting around watching Fox and Friends with his chest covered in crumbs and sauce, and he just tweeted what he saw. And that is inconsistent with this is a grand strategy that him and Stephen Miller cooked up and deployed at the exact right time.
Yeah, I'm sorry. And on top of that first tweet, the series of tweets at least, he connected Nancy Pelosi with it. When there's supposed to be this infighting that suddenly, you know, he wants to wed them all together so he can help his election chances. He included her in the last tweet saying, I'm sure Nancy Pelosi will be in board for that. So he thought that it was still happening. He
thought there was still definitely a Looney Tunes thing, but yeah.
So he was thinking, I'm gonna continue to push this divide because Nancy Pelosi hates these four and these four hate her. And then, so how did that suddenly turn into this unification push?
Yeah, one other thing too. If you do believe that he is still the 11-dimensional chess guy, remember he did spell Al-Qaeda A-L-C-A-I-D-A. So there's a few flaws with that, but Let's pretend for a second that it is a strategy, because some of his supporters want it to be. Some people on the other side are worried about his strategy. Some people, mostly centrist Dems, are like, you know what? It would be bad if we were tied to AOC and the squad. Oh my God, can you imagine if Ilhan Omar and Ayanna Pressley were the face of the party? That's terrifying, but is it actually terrifying? Let's take a look at some of the data we have. Now, on the statement itself, YouGov poll, very clear. We can have Britt Hume saying it wasn't racist and we can debate it here, but the American public is almost twice as likely to say that it was racist as not. That 30%, by the way, is almost exactly Trump's base. I'm not saying that there's direct overlap there necessarily, but the American public is very clear. The statements were in fact racist. And now we actually have polls on what that statement might have done to people's view of Donald Trump. Now, the good news for Trump, I guess, is that a new Reuters Ipsos poll showed his net approval among members of the Republican Party rose by 5 percentage points from last week. So as always, at the same exact time as they're arguing that no, blank wasn't racist, behind the scenes they're like, I really like that thing that he
absolutely
said.
Absolutely,
totally not racist, but I love it and I love him more for it.
Yeah, they said it straight up. So the push that's saying that, oh, this is working for him as far as his election chances is only amongst his racist base. So to say that, hey, that's gonna help him or this is his strategy to win, maybe it is once it happens, everything he does is a strategy to win because everything he does is based in racism. So the people that support him, they get him in the first place are like, oh yeah, this is our guy. I remember from 2016, because he did it then too. This isn't different.
And those people were gonna vote for him anyway. Now, outside of that base though, is this a good strategy from the master chess player from Donald Deep Blue Trump? Well, among independents, about 3 out of 10 said they approved of Trump, down from 4 out of 10 a week ago. So he lost, I'm not a mathematician, but something like a third, or I guess that would be a fourth of his support amongst independents in 1 week. That's like, even in this poll, they're talking about it like, oh yeah, you know, the numbers went down. That seems, how do you do that? How difficult is that to do in 1 week? And the thing is, like, he can't just win Republicans. Remember, he already lost the popular vote. He narrowly won the Electoral College, super narrow. He can't afford to get like 5 independents across the country.
You're forgetting
about the strategy sucks.
Well, you're forgetting about the second half of the electoral strategy for Republicans is voter suppression.
That's true.
That's
yeah, they do have that.
That's a strong wing of the campaign strategy.
That's true. That's true. But this is, I mean, if this is your strategy, this is devastating. And it turns out he's not happy right now. Not because that he's losing the independence or whatever, but apparently, this is from Politico, President Trump is reportedly dissatisfied with Republican lawmakers for their lack of defense of his weekend tweets. Everybody was defending him. Like, everyone was if he said that, you know, I'm actually my favorite band's Chumbawamba, he wouldn't have gotten as solidified support from the Republican Party as these racist tweets.
Since Trump is their father, it's like one of those fathers who make sure they're continuously hard on their son no matter how well the kid does. Mm-hmm. The kid does something, he goes, oh, that's not good enough, kid. Yeah. I'm gonna keep making because I don't actually wanna voice any kind of support for your life. And so they continue to stay subservient based on that.
There are multiple elected Republicans, even in the Senate, who have themselves told these women to go home since then. How much more support could you have? But he's, you know, he's sad at home. Okay, so we are gonna take a break. We come back, we're gonna be joined Seema Hernandez running against John Cornyn. Very exciting candidacy, which we're gonna break down after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, you must unlearn what you have learned. And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
As important as defeating Donald Trump in 2020 is to get anything done, a new Democratic president is going to need a friendly Senate. And that means picking off a number of Republicans in the Senate this time around. One being targeted now is Republican Senator of Texas, John Cornyn. And joining us now is the challenger to John Cornyn, Seema Hernandez. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Hi, John. Thank you for having me here.
Very glad to have you on. First of all, I think our audience knows a little bit about John Cornyn, but we'll certainly provide some critique of him. But for those who might not be familiar with you and your history in Texas, what you bring as a candidate, why don't you introduce yourself to our audience?
So I'm Seema Hernandez. I identify as Latinx and Indigenous. I am an organizer, I am a collaborator, I am also a president of a nonprofit organization dedicated to environmental justice issues here in our area. And I'm also a Fenceline community member who lives in a sacrifice zone that is inundated by the petrochemical industry in Pasadena, Texas.
Awesome. So you have a lot of history in the state organizing on a number of different issues. You'd also been a former co-chair in Texas of the Poor People's Campaign, correct?
That is correct.
So, I mean, basically across the spectrum of issues, from economic to environmental and all that, obviously there's a linkage there. A great work in that in the past. So, what led you to want to challenge John Cornyn? What is it about his record that you wanted to take him out for?
Well, aside from the fact that he takes a lot of money from the petrochemical industry, he also takes money from the private prison industrial complex that is benefiting from the detention and separation and basically kidnapping of the families at the border looking to seek asylum in this country, which is completely constitutional. It is legal. And for him to deny that and continue to perpetuate this separation policy is unconstitutional, and it goes against domestic and international laws.
I couldn't agree more. And of course, yeah, I mean, you're running in Texas. It's one of the states, obviously, where that issue is most front and center. Hypothetically, if let's say you were a senator right now, what would you like to see done? What would you do on that issue if you had authority in the Senate right now?
Well, definitely defunding the ICE detention centers, dismantling ICE, DHS, Customs and Border Patrol, and funding the processing of asylum seekers rather than funding the concentration camps is what I would focus on as well. a senator, I would also fund a green, renewable, and sustainable infrastructure here in the state of Texas and across the country, depending on the region in which we are located, so that we can better prepare ourselves for the ecological devastation that is coming to this, to our generation.
So in just the last go-round, you had Beto O'Rourke running against Ted Cruz. It was a very, very close race. What do you think about the future of these sort of state-level races? Obviously, you're engaged in one in Texas. What do you think about the Democrats' chances in upcoming electoral cycles?
Well, I think that the chances are great if we focus more on policy, we focus more on organizing, instead of focusing on how much money can be raised. Because raising $80 million is not indicative of winning an election. You have to have the people and engage them and talk about policies that directly impact voters so that we can get them out to vote. It's not about competing for Republican voters. It's about competing for a true democracy that represents and reflects who we're representing in each and every state.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that, because in some of the most high profile attempts from the centrist Democrats to take out Republicans in Senate races in the past few cycles, they have gone for those Republican votes, and it's generally been a massive failure. So if it was up to you, what issues do you want to see be the centerpiece of this Senate race against John Cornyn?
Environmental justice, healthcare, immigration, sustainable, renewable infrastructure. We have to be better equipped and better prepared to take on this global warming crisis, and definitely tackling on the issues of American imperialism and the military-industrial complex. We have to stop funding the wars and start funding peace, because we know that the military-industrial complex directly impacts the global warming and the humanitarian crisis that is now at our borders.
So you've brought up these environmental concerns a couple of different times, and obviously, I mean, that to me is the most important issue, and so I'm glad to see a candidate focusing so much on it. If you enter into the Senate, do you see yourself being a proponent in the Senate, a possible co-sponsor to something like the Green New Deal, or do you have an alternative approach to deal with these issues?
Well, the Green New Deal right now is it's a resolution, so it's upon us to build on that and focusing on what we can do better prepare our states, our regions, and invigorate the economy with green, renewable jobs and sustainable infrastructure, and utilizing the military to lay down that groundwork in other countries instead of using the military to terrorize and bomb black and brown countries. We should be helping to mobilize a green energy infrastructure worldwide.
So in terms of the primary, I did want to resolve one thing. So this interview actually came about as a result of me sort of semi-jokingly tweeting at Beto O'Rourke that his recent efforts in the presidential primary have obviously not been going very well, and he should drop out and just run for Senate. I do want to be clear, I wasn't implying any sort of endorsement for Beto O'Rourke. I mainly just wanted him out of the presidential race. But if he did drop out, if he did challenge you, what would your strategy be to differentiate yourself from someone like a Beto O'Rourke in this election?
Well, I think I've done very well in doing that in 2018, and doing it again in 2020 in this election is setting the groundwork for what we've done on a collaborative issue with other candidates and grassroots organizing, and making sure that the message gets across. And we've seen him sign on to deals that then he went back on, such as the No Fossil Fuel Money Pledge. He didn't uphold it, and I myself signed it in 2018. I did it first in the Senate race, and I did it again in 2020. So these are things that we've already done, and it's just continuing to lead in those important issues. So if he wants to drop out and come into the Senate race, I fully encourage that, and I welcome that, because we know that mediocre policies with centrist Democrats will not invigorate a base that has been longing for a candidate that will truly stand up and fight for them, not just when they're in office, but before they're in office. And that's what I've been doing for the last 34 years that I've been alive and barely breathing.
Wow. Okay. Well, that is a strong response. It would be exciting to see you debate a Beto O'Rourke. I've covered some of his debates. I don't know exactly how he would stand up to some of what you've said here. So very exciting candidacy. Sam Hernandez, want to thank you for joining us, and good luck in your race.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, new developments in the case of R. Kelly and Jeffrey Epstein that we'll be breaking down after this. Things just keep getting worse for R. Kelly, and that is such a shame, because it turns out that a new development in several of the multiple legal, I guess, the threads that are running against him right now, there's a new force arrayed against him, and it has to do with that notorious and horrendous tape from many years ago. If you're not familiar with the tape, I don't believe you, but here's what the tape was about. It was sold as a bootleg on the streets of New York, LA, and Chicago. It showed R. Kelly, this is from the New York Times, saying having sex, but it's that he's raping a girl because she can't consent because she's a child, urinating on her as well. That tape was shown at his trial in 2008, but at the time, the girl who was shown being raped on the tape and her family refused to testify. That girl, now a woman in her 30s, said on Tuesday that she was cooperating with federal investigators. This comes just days after Mr. Kelly was accused in a federal indictment of paying the girl and her father to stay quiet, and in some cases to lie to investigators to protect him. So it's possible that she has been working with the investigators since before that quote. But either way, not good development for
him. Yeah, and they said, apparently, this is again from the first trial from back, was it 08?
2008, yeah. Although the tape, I'm not sure when the tape was initially filmed.
Right. This earlier was like the linchpin into, or not the linchpin, I guess. This is the pin that was loose, was the reason why R. Kelly was able to get off from that, because his manipulation for these particular, the victim and her family, to make sure they didn't say much or do the things that would help implicate him. Mm-hmm. So that was part of the reason why much of the jury in that case said, oh, well, you know, we can't know for sure because she didn't participate in it, and also we can't tell for sure that it's him. So this development is big enough that we could see, I still think, from what the jury wrongfully did in the first trial, this is what would allow them to finally see what's always been going on. Mm-hmm. And by the way, she's not the only victim. Mm-hmm. So it's not like this is the only thing that's needed, but maybe this is what people who are too dense to understand what's happening can get a chance to finally figure it out.
Yeah, I actually had forgotten there was serious debate as to whether it was him.
Yep.
That seems...
Can't really tell from the tape, despite identifying marks on him. Mm-hmm. And also, I believe they said some of her friends could identify her like from that. But you know, as long as she didn't come forward, it wasn't really the thing.
Yeah, well, that does make it tougher, although we can understand why. I mean, she had already been through hell, apparently continuing to, because of his manipulation, you know, behind the scenes. I can understand why that would be an incredibly difficult thing to take part in public. Now, just to catch up, Mr. Kelly is now facing numerous state and federal charges, including sexual assault, obstruction of justice, child pornography, and racketeering. Prosecutors said he has victimized 12 women, at least 8 of whom were underage at the time of the indictments. Wow. And it's like, to go back to the beginnings of this and the attempt in 2008, which was obviously foiled for a variety of reasons, mm-hmm. as we've just discussed. But going back even before that, like, what a long road to any kind of consequences. And it certainly seems like that's the way that things are moving right now, although, you know, don't count your chickens, nobody knows. But considering the new evidence that they have, the newfound multiple investigations, and now cooperation from someone who basically knows all there is to know about this, it definitely looks like we're moving.
There was so much happening. Also, the singer Sparkle, who apparently was a protege of R. Kelly's, she had a big song with him. That was her niece. Mm-hmm. That was in that video. So there's lots of connections to who and how he's near some of these girls that he was around. And also that singer Sparkle has been trying to get this, has been testifying against him, has been continuously cooperating with the authorities against him, and is actually now happy that maybe things are moving in the right direction. But for some reason, her word also wasn't taken as much, exactly, as much validity.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, in this sort of case, I guess I would expect that, you know, he still has a measure of celebrity. No, it's so amazing that you went to that, because I was just going to say, like, you know, this is all these developments, you would want to respond in some way. But after the way that last interview went, that could only hurt him at this point. And so I don't know exactly what the legal strategy is. It seems like behind the scenes they're doing some, you know, intimidation and payments and things like that, but that doesn't seem to be sustainable anymore.
There was many things with that. Also that, you know, there was his current girls that were with him there, mm-hmm. and then they heard them off on the side, and he was telling them to kind of, there's a lot of behind the scene things that happened during that interview that was even worse than what we saw.
Oh yeah. Okay, well, let's turn to a somewhat related case, actually, updates on Jeffrey Epstein. Jeffrey Epstein's connection with Donald Trump, we've been sort of trying to flesh it out for some time, and Donald Trump has been very clear recently that he's not a fan of Epstein, doesn't respect him. This idea that they were ever really friends or anything like that, that's ridiculous. Well, there's new video now that's been released. MSNBC made this available earlier today. This is from a party back in 1992. I believe it's at Mar-a-Lago. But in any event, the mansion that they're at was about to be turned into a resort. And before that, they were having a big party. And some video shows Donald Trump welcoming some very noteworthy guests to this party.
After a while, Trump goes to greet three new guests, among them the financier Jeffrey Epstein. More than a decade before his guilty plea on state prostitution charges. Later in the footage, Trump is seen talking to Epstein and another man as women are dancing in front of them. Trump alternates between dancing and pointing out women to Epstein and the other man and telling Epstein about the cameras. Though exactly what they say is difficult to understand as they discuss the women and their appearances, Trump gestures to one and appears to say to Epstein, "Look at her back there. She's hot." And then Trump says something else into Epstein's ear that makes him double over with laughter. But as the president says now, he never liked Epstein.
I was not a fan of his, that I can tell you. I was not a fan of his.
What are you gonna believe? Donald Trump with your lying eyes. Not a fan, doesn't respect him. What sort of, for a guy like Epstein, multiple allegations, multiple child rapist, what sort of thing makes him double over in laughter when you're pointing at a group of women? I don't know. We may never know. We need to get some sort of liberating expert or something.
So, as some people who may support him unwaveringly would say, there's grown women at this party. Mm-hmm. Men can hang out at the sides and talk about which women they think are attractive. Oh, that's just normal stuff. Mm-hmm. But this is put up against him saying how much he hated Jeffrey
Exactly.
Epstein. And I saw him around the scene. He was a Palm Beach guy. Everyone knew him. He's a Palm Beach guy. He was just a Palm Beach guy. And then when you see him having these lovable conversations with him, that's when you go, well, why would you lie that you weren't his friend? Mm-hmm. You were his friend. Everyone knew that already because there's other previous quotes that you had that we knew who you were his friend. So now when you just completely deny any friendship with him, then that makes us go, well, why would you deny the obvious?
Yeah.
I mean, outside of the fact that your name is Donald Trump and you always deny the obvious truth. But then you go, well, what else were you lying about? That's really what this leads to more than anything else. Not because this particular party is something incriminating mm-hmm. about them standing there being sleazy looking
exactly,
guys.
Exactly.
They were just being normal sleazy guys.
Yeah. Yeah, normal sleazy, embarrassing, cringy guys. We'll return to that in just one second. But yeah, it's the, look, if it's clear that you're lying to us, it makes people wonder, of course. And since you're not providing any more information, we have to sort of try to fill in the gaps. Yep. And you were clearly friendly with him. You're inviting him over. It's not like there were 100 people in that room. They flashed over to the dance floor. Like these are billionaires. That was a sad looking party. There was a group of women who were there because Donald Trump's got money or whatever. And there's like a couple people around the periphery. Like clearly it's a pretty select clientele that you're inviting to that party. And yet Jeffrey Epstein, the weirdo, he is one of the people that you chose. That does not mean that you committed any crimes mm-hmm. with him necessarily. It doesn't mean that you know of any crimes, although your past statements imply that you did. But it does show that you were relatively good friends with him at the time. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, we're collecting a picture of what this relationship seemed like and what we've seen and heard from him. Not from people who hate him. You know, this is just Trump haters making things up. We're getting these words from his mouth, mm-hmm. things that he has said. And also just I just want to highlight the worst, most cringy part of that video is when they said, and Donald Trump is dancing, he does this.
Oh, he did the lip. He also does the weird random clap.
Oh yeah.
Like it just like a, and there's other parts of it. You can watch the full thing and he's dancing. And honestly, at some point the women are surrounding him and everything. I'm sure they're all very, very attracted to him. But he's the same person now as he was then. The ridiculously long tie, the weird haircut, the bizarre, cringy dancing and everything. And this is not like what I'm taking off my news analyst hat. I just have never understood how people called him a playboy in the past. He had money, sure, but that's who he was.
That's all it takes, is that money.
I guess, that was a pathetic display.
Yeah, he's also the same guy because he pointed out, NBC News is there, he pointed out, and also early in that whole longer clip, he told the news crew, he goes, this is gonna be great ratings, this is gonna be great ratings. Mm-hmm. Does that sound familiar?
Same exact person.
Same person.
Yeah,
nothing has changed.
Anyway, so the final point, I wonder what other shape they have. I mean, this is a guy who desperately tried to get on tape as much as possible. go through your archives, MSNBC and CNN. Like, you guys were operating back then. What else do you have? Anyway, we'll see. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back. Joe Biden's response on how he would stand strong against Donald Trump. We're gonna respond to that after this. Whoever the eventual nominee is for the Democrats, we know that on the debate stage, Donald Trump loves to try to intimidate people in his what I see as pathetic attempt. But he does. And so what about Joe Biden, a guy who, you know, in the last time that he was on a debate stage, he didn't have a very good performance, didn't defend himself very well. How would he defend himself against Donald Trump? Well, Biden was asked this by Mika Brzezinski, and he acknowledged that some people have been left with the impression that he's not necessarily up to the task of defending himself. His energy levels aren't high enough, he's not passionate and fiery enough. So what if they bring up his age on the stage? What if Donald Trump does that? Well, he responded, I'd say, come on, Donald, come on, man. How many push-ups do you want to do here, pal? I mean, jokingly, come on, run with me, man. That's what he said. And I can't tell, JR, I need you, because I can't tell if I hate that response just because I'm not predisposed to support Joe Biden, or if because it's a bad response and it's kind of cringy. What do you think?
I'm judging your reaction.
No, I'm judging, you judge his statement. Well, is that a good response? Is that a strong response?
It's okay. I'll give him 70% on it. It wasn't
70%?
Awesome.
Okay.
But that's like, you know, yeah, it's average. Like, it's okay because he did throw in there jokingly, because Trump is going to be like, Trump has his nicknames. I think the question she asked him was like, he has his nickname for you, Sleepy Joe. And he mentioned how before he's run some kind of distance race and someone was heckling him. And he goes, come on and join me then, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm doing it. How about you join me since you're such a tough guy, right? In a way, so that the opposition has to prove themselves after just sitting on the sidelines. It's like being a fan of a sport and talking trash about these elite athletes and then throwing chips in your face. You're like, well, come on and do it. Like, oh, man, if he can't make that throw, that's just a dump off pass. I can't believe my quarterback did that. It's like, you get out here and throw it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's when, and then when people actually try it, they find out, oh, my God. Or if a receiver, that's this, when a receiver drops a pass, they go, oh, you couldn't catch that. Try it. Mm-hmm. And you cannot catch it either. So I get that approach. The hard thing is just the way the question was asked. If he's bringing this up without the question being asked, then I'm more on the, what are we bringing this running and push-ups thing up for? But the question was asked. I'm not sure how much better he could have put it.
Yeah. The thing that makes it a little bit difficult, we have another past statement by Joe Biden in this line that I like a little bit better, sort of, is other people have had to try to respond to this. I mean, you had, he was weirdly stalking Hillary Clinton on the debate stage. And then before that, when he was on the stage with a million Republicans, he was just wildly insulting them.
Absolutely.
He made fun of Rand Paul's hair at a debate. So that's the context that we're in. And when trying to figure out how do you respond to that, the question is, do you go down into the muck? Do you do to him what he does to other people? And there doesn't really seem to be any good response, because what he's doing is reprehensible.
Right. I think the best way is if you make yourself look like the adult in the room, but not being the annoyed adult in the room. So I could even go with the push-up comment, right? Like, say Trump throws around some names and there's a debate. And then so Biden can say, hey, you know, join me then, Donald, but let me talk about the issue. So you can say your quick little insult, then get back to being an adult. So where his things don't annoy you and doesn't visibly annoy you. And then at the same time, people who maybe support him or are on the fence will go, that guy isn't the type of guy I like.
Yeah.
The one who's losing this argument, that's the child, but isn't, everyone's not playing the child game, which is what the Republicans did last time. They all jumped into the sandbox with him.
I guess that's more of what I want, because the thing is, like, if the question is Joe Biden energetic and passionate enough? If he busts out some burpees, that does not answer my concern. My concern is whether he's going to be a fighter for us, not in the, like, the in the octagon, you know. I want to know if he's going to be a fighter on the issues that I care about. And so I would love it if he could just push off that sort of ridiculous criticism, right, and then be an advocate in a passionate, fiery, energetic way on the issues that we care about.
I mean, I don't need the burpees, but I would love to see a few wall sits.
Imagine if he did the entire debate in a wall set. That would be sending a strong signal that our politics are the worst. Okay, so one past thing that he had said. This is back when, remember when the Access Hollywood tape came out? Yes. Well, it was a tape in which Donald Trump, you know what it is. So at that point, Biden had told, this is in March of 2018, but in response to it, he said, if we were in high school, I'd take him behind the gym and beat the hell out of him. I've been a lot of locker rooms my whole life. I'm a pretty damn good athlete. I don't support Joe Biden. And I obviously don't support political violence, but that's pretty funny.
Yeah, I mean, again, think about it. You talked about the things that they insulted each other at in the last cycle with the Republican primary. I mean, they talked about penis size, bro.
Oh my God, they did.
He said, and again, trust me, I have no problem in that area. Trust me.
Mm-hmm.
This is for the nomination for the president of the United States, and we said it at the time, but it doesn't really matter anymore.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know if it needs to be said, but in the same way that Brett Ehrlich said yesterday on the show that no one has ever said go back to your country that's not a racist. No one has ever said no. I don't have any problems down there. Who honestly doesn't have any problems down there? As if he could see anyway. What a ridiculous country we live in. What a ridiculous
process. I have no problems down there. I really don't see anything, so it must not be a problem.
Yeah, and so on the first statement, I don't know. Like, I'm trying to think if Bernie challenged him to do dips. Would I like that? I hope that I would not. On the saying what he would do if they were in high school, I would have liked it if Bernie had said that. So I got to give Biden credit for that.
I mean, maybe something that you have to practice, like a quick little quip back, but then continuing on with your point. You know, be like, hey, Donald, I'm going to let you play in the sandbox while I explain this to the adults. You know, a quick little thing like that. You keep with the name calling. I have my 16-year-old babysit you while I answer this question.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, well, so I mean, this is so premature, obviously, but we're going to get to there, and it's going to be interesting to see how he would respond depending on who the candidate is. And I think it really will matter because we've got a wide range of candidates. Okay, with that, we're going to take a short break. We come back, climate news roundup from around the world after this. Every week, something new dominates the headlines. That's just the way it is, and we do have to cover those things. But we can't forget that lurking in the background, our climate is breaking down. And so I wanted to do just a brief overview of a few of the stories that caught my eye that have to do with our climate, our environment, and weather. And these are a real doozy, including records being broken. So temperatures hit a record 69.8 degrees Fahrenheit in a town called Alert, the northernmost permanently inhabited spot on the planet, less than 600 miles from the North Pole. So we're talking very close there, record temperatures being hit. And a meteorologist with the Canadian Environmental Ministry said of that high, such highs so far north are completely staggering. I mean, look, we occasionally show those maps of like the Arctic where on average it's 40 degrees warmer than it's supposed to be. These records are often hit. I mean, that's breaking a record from, I think it's more than 70 years ago now. And I mean, should we really be shocked considering what's going on around the globe?
We're waiting for the winter to come so that snowballs can be made
in
Washington, D.C. and say, hey, you know, it still snows in the world, so therefore there's nothing to be concerned about. It's a consistent battle between like, you know, a clear cut argument that's based in science that's asked from professionals versus people who just want to make small claims for every once in a while. So even in this case, if you present this to people who deny that we've got climate issues happening, then they'll just say, oh man, it's summertime, it's supposed to be. Like just and write it off without thinking about the context and that we're talking about the northernmost inhabitable place in the world.
600 miles from
and
the North Pole.
That number was nearly 70 degrees?
Nearly 70 degrees, yeah.
It's nearly 70 degrees every morning on the west side of LA where I live because there's cloud cover and then it's just overnight, even though it'll get up to 85, 90 degrees, not even yet. But we have it. The fact that we got Southern California in the same time frame at the same temperature range as somewhere like this, that's the comparisons. The small things need to be made. And it doesn't have to be something every day
Yeah.
The fact that it happens is a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know that I think this stands out because we're talking about something very far north and a record being set for some people. They're going to be like, what do I care what happens that far north? Well, okay, it doesn't necessarily affect you on your commute, but we've talked about the melting of the permafrost and how much extra carbon that's going to release. Again, these things, it's not like everything's just proceeding along in a bad direction, sort of going up over time. Sometimes you tip in various ways and it makes the entire process that much worse. But I get it. You've never been to Alert. I've never been to Alert. Okay, let's talk about heat coming to a town near you. By 2050, hundreds of US cities could see an entire month each year with heat index temperatures above 100 degrees if nothing is done to rein in global warming. On some days, conditions would be so extreme that they'd exceed the upper limit of the heat index, rendering it incalculable, a study predicts. So we're talking about a wide band of the United States where for a significant chunk of the year, we would have temperatures averaging over 100 degrees. That's not the way it is right now. And that's not only noteworthy, that's dangerous because in those situations when it happens now, people die. We're talking about extended periods of that just settling on an area of the United States. Many people will lose their lives.
In areas where it usually isn't happening, of course. Again, we know in parts of Texas and of course in Arizona and stuff where we know it gets hot in the summertime, there's those warnings. I remember when I was a kid, I lived in St. Louis, there was those warnings that would be like, heat index today is a problem. If you don't have air conditioning, if you're elderly and maybe aren't wealthy and elderly, they were giving out air conditionings to people because just the nature of the human body to take that kind of heat is not normal. You're gonna die.
Exactly, and look, we saw in the heat wave in Europe, people were dying. France had the highest temperature ever recorded in France happen during this most recent heat wave. And we talked about why in places like Germany, for instance, where I think I read 2% of the population has an air conditioner. In those areas, when heat waves strike, more people die because they're not set up in a way to deal with it. Well, hopefully we'll respond across the United States because it looks like this is coming to a lot of cities. On the deaths thing I was talking about, climatology professor Adam Kalkenstein said heat is already a leading cause of weather-related mortality across the country and is frequently called the silent killer since its impacts on human health are often underestimated. If the models used here are correct, this research leaves little doubt that the number of potentially dangerous days across the country will increase dramatically and not equally. Because nothing in our politics is equal. Some people will be more susceptible. Certain communities, obviously the elderly and heat waves are of course at more risk. Well, get ready for that to come to more and more cities across the United States.
What else you got, John? Something else is happening because of this.
What else? Oh, I do have something. So, okay, so record-breaking heat waves, that's not a big deal. The heat waves across the United States. What about turbulence? That's a weird thing to talk about in this context, but there was recently a really bad instance of it. I once had turbulence over Vegas that made me want to throw up in my seat. That sounded as bad as it could get. No, it gets worse. 37 passengers and crew members were injured Thursday when flight AC-33 hit severe clear air turbulence and was forced to divert to Honolulu's international airport. Those on board told reporters they hit the ceiling of the cabin when the aircraft unexpectedly dropped. So understand this severe clear air turbulence, which I just learned about. You can't see it, you can't predict it. It doesn't last for a long period of time. We have no way to detect it, but when you hit it, a plane can drop more than 30 meters faster than gravity. So faster than if the engines turned off and it fell. And so yes, if you're not buckled in, you will hit the ceiling, injuring or perhaps killing yourself in the process. So why are we talking about this at this time? Well, according to Paul Williams, professor of atmospheric science, climate change is modifying the jet stream and just increasing those instabilities in the jet stream. We are predicting a major increase in severe invisible clear air turbulence by several 100% in the next few decades.
So Paul Williams and Adam Kalkenstein, who was climatology professor, this is another professor about climate and how the air pressure is changing things with flights. Remember the original argument against doing anything about this for many conservatives was, hey, these guys are making too much money off of this. What money are you making off of this? How much money can these people like these professors and scientists be making off of telling you, hey, this event that actually happened because of this, which you don't understand, which I've been studying my whole life, longer than you've been around, and then and then we just write it off. What money can be made that's that important versus the money that can be made to continue to destroy the environment so that plants can be done, so your power plants can continue to be operational and you pollute the environment for your own money-making schemes?
Yeah.
Which one is getting cash?
That's a good point. And look, I know these are all depressing stories, unfortunately. Sorry, that's just the way it goes, but we have to remember that this is going on. And the right loves to talk about the Green New Deal. They want to get rid of your planes. Okay, they don't. But what about doing nothing and just planes being a place that you vomit a bunch and perhaps break your neck? That sounds like a bad future. Let's avoid it if we can. JR, as always, thank you for joining us on Wednesday. Great to have you here. Thank you, everybody, for watching. We will see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.